This is Book Radio. I'm Mark Strassman. Our guest today is Arianna Huffington, who's just written Greetings from the Lincoln Bedroom. Welcome to Book Radio.
Thank you, Mark.
When I heard you had written this satirical look at the contemporary political scene in Washington, I thought, she's given up trying to be Plato, and now she wants to be Aristophanes. Is that right?
Well, certainly somebody to aspire to. Aristophanes, Jonathan Swift, Mark Twain, these are the great political heroes of mine when it comes to satire. And certainly, I believe increasingly, as American politics is becoming more and more surrealistic, that there just isn't enough political satire. And that was definitely the motivation behind writing Greetings from the Lincoln Bedroom.
Would you say there's much difference in the things that politicians did in Swift's day or Aristophanes' day or our day that get them made fun of by writers?
I think there's a greater amount of spin and damage control and nonsense being fed to the American people. So you would have thought there would be a greater opportunity to satirize and ridicule and laugh at the expense of our political leaders. But unfortunately, there isn't. In fact, we have a lot of late-night comedy jokes, but that's different. It's almost like a ghetto, disconnected from political coverage and political conviction.
Even last night, there was the Washington Press Corps dinner, which had its own existence and, you know, sort of everyone's night out. But then on Monday, everyone's back to the same set of
behaviors. Even at that dinner, I was there actually last night, and
right.
I was absolutely amazed that traditionally there's an entertainer
right.
who is the sort of representative of the Fourth Estate,
right.
ridiculing the president. And
right.
last night, there was absolutely not one word about the president. It was all the kind of act you would see in Las Vegas. So
right.
people are becoming more and more worried about satire, which is unfortunate.
Is that because the system itself is so on the brink of being totally absurd that they don't dare let the slightest amount of serious humorous criticism into the system?
That would be the positive explanation.
Okay.
The negative explanation is that the Washington establishment of both parties and the media is protecting itself.
Right.
And it's become a protection racket. And satire is disruptive. I mean, people who've read my book are disturbed from both sides of the aisle, you know, because I'm an equal opportunity offender and take on Clinton and Gingrich in this adventure that supposedly takes place in the White House over a long weekend.
When you write satire or anything, really, do you write it to, you have four choices here, change the world, express yourself, earn a living, or just to entertain people? Or any combination there?
One and four.
Yes.
And change the world and entertain people.
Okay.
So I hope that people who read about Socks the Cat being my guide
right.
in the White House can just take it as a comic invention and hopefully love Socks as the moral conscience of the book.
Right.
But I also hope that others will listen to what Socks is saying about the bankruptcy of leadership in his cat-like way, so that it's less preachy and more satirical.
Right. He has a good, he has a positive image, and you're sort of piggybacking, I think.
Exactly, yes.
Mixing animal metaphor. Let's talk a little specifically about what it is that makes politics so satirizable these days. Starting with money in politics, you were involved very closely in a campaign here in California that pitted a slightly really rich person against a really, really rich person. What did you see there inside that campaign that you might want to share with us that could give us some kind of hint or clue about what the impact, but also sort of the dynamics of needing to be a millionaire to run for office in California these days?
Well, actually, what I saw is in the book. I saw the dominance of polling in campaigns.
Right.
Increasingly, both in my ex-husband's campaign, and we see it now in Al Checky's campaign and Jane Harman's campaign, that pollsters and consultants are really determining the message. And that's why in my website, ArianaOnline.com, I have launched a campaign against pollsters called Partnership for a Poll-Free America,
okay.
where we urge people to just hang up on pollsters
right.
until we contaminate the sample and stop depending on polls as much.
I'll support that.
Good.
Skipping to some of your earlier work, you wrote a book called Picasso, Creator and Destroyer that became the basis of the movie with Anthony Hopkins and so on. And this was a study of the relationship between a genius who was bad, the genius of a man, the subject was a genius who was bad to women. we've got a person in the White House who I don't know about his ability to paint, but in terms of political knowing the political moves, I mean, he is close to the best in many things of any person for a long time. And as to women, there's the women as an issue, women on an individual basis. You want to say anything to sort of compare Picasso and Bill Clinton in terms of the paradigms that you developed for the Picasso book in terms of his behavior as a political genius, but having another side to him as well?
Well, there is a parallel. The parallel is the belief of many powerful people that the ends justify the means, and we see that a lot with Clinton. He talks about it in the book when he's in the hot tub with Newt Gingrich and the two of them discuss all the bipartisan conclusions.
Right.
And I think throughout history we know that the ends should not justify the means, because very often the means is all we're left with.
The ends are all...
No, the means. You know, we never reach the end. Yeah.
Right.
So basically,
and so it's a world of means.
It's a world of means,
and that's what we're experiencing.
And that's exactly.
not the ends, and the ends are just the Soviet Union being a pretty good example
Absolutely,
of that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
How do you find it possible to write satire in an age that is itself on the brink of becoming totally parodic at every point? For example, yes. Well, you answer the question rather than me giving.
Well, really, answer. By choosing a complete fantasy.
Right.
As my premise. You know, the premise that I spend a long weekend in the White House with socks as my deep throat, right, with a talking television that has a BS chip and translates politician statements into English,
right,
with the vice president being a talking statue in the basement, with Hillary having a seance to channel Rosalind Carter to discuss the role of a first lady.
Right.
These are all elements that are so fantastical that I hope it will take a while before reality catches up with them.
Well,
unless you know something I don't.
experiencing the Jerry Springer controversy in the last few days, I thought, why don't we liven up some of the political talk shows by having the guests who disagree with each other get up and start fighting? And then I turned on the TV, and there was Henry Waxman and Dan Burton in the House Judiciary Committee deciding whether scumbag and reprehensible meant the same thing or not. And I said, the curve is moving too fast to stay ahead of it. So we'll have to see what happens. And a lot of this comes from there being a contentless politics, so it seems to me. Two things that I wanted to comment on. I've never seen in the almost 40 years that I've been involved in politics one way or the other, I've never seen the country less political, more apolitical, not wanting to think about it, care about it, do anything about it. The Congress seems to be doing nothing except making a fool of itself in various ways. Is this just sort of a necessary consequence of things being pretty good for most people?
I don't think things are very good.
Okay,
I think
that's
what is the problem. That, as Lincoln says when he comes and visits me in the Lincoln bedroom,
right,
America is becoming two nations, and the entire political conversation, such as it is,
right,
is about the first nation, the
right
nation that's benefiting from the growing economy and
right
the high Dow Jones, and the second nation of the inner cities, the crumbling public schools, is basically completely ignored by both parties. And that's the thing, is perhaps the greatest danger we're facing.
Well, of course, we have only a minute and a half left, but you're widely viewed and categorized, labeled as a conservative, yet you're raising the issue of the poor and downtrodden and oppressed and outcast, which I haven't heard any of the liberals bringing up lately.
Well, some liberals bring it up, but also
right
don't forget that the two nations concept and phrase
right
was coined by Benjamin Disraeli,
right,
who was a Tory.
Right.
So there is no liberal sort of monopoly over compassion.
Right.
I think that increasingly both parties have become part of one political class.
Right.
And I personally am in a very, what I call, post-partisan mood.
Right.
Where I want basically the people to sort of rise and change their masters from both parties.
Okay, well, we've got 45 seconds.
I'll tell you how to do it.
Could you tell us how to do it?
Well, the first thing is a few acts of civil disobedience. Hang up on pollsters.
Right, but the pollsters aren't the... Or are you arguing that they
the
are part of the civil authority?
Absolutely,
they're part
yes
of the civil
the
authority.
The pollsters have,
okay,
to a large
okay
extent, ruined political leadership.
Okay. Right.
So that would be number one. Do acts like heckling politicians. The,
really?
The
you
way
mean,
Columbus,
right,
Ohio, you know,
right,
is a great example of how a few hecklers could change American foreign policy over Iraq.
Larry Beinhart, who I've interviewed twice, said that when the administration sent out Sandy Berger and Madeleine Albright and William Cohen to Ohio, they were heckled. They called off the second Iraq
right
war.
It just shows how
okay
easy it is.
So we got hang up on posters, heckle.
Heckle.
Right.
And basically evoke a greater sense of outrage in everything we do. Stop being so passive and docile about consuming the political problem we are being fed.
Well, but this is the strategy, though. If it reminds me of anything recently, it's ACT UP, the group of AIDS activists who said, we want these drugs, we want them now, we're not going to put up with government bureaucracy, we're going to break the law, we're going to commit civil disobedience, and so on, get attention and call it, and so on. That's essentially what you're advocating, that approach?
I'm advocating every possible act of civil disobedience that is peaceful, that is not violent, and that brings attention to this great neglect we're facing and this incredible infantilization of American politics.
But if 80% of the people consider themselves satisfied, or the
they don't, people, first of all. It's
There are
about 60% of people who answer the question, is the country on the right or the wrong track?
Right.
And they say we're on the right track, about 60%. But that's a very shallow consensus. And as the people in Columbus, Ohio proved, it takes very few people who are very committed, a critical mass of people, to turn things around and produce real reform.
Your strategy for solving the problems of the inner cities is not to tax the rich and give the money to the people in the inner cities, is it?
My strategy is to commit citizens to some form of volunteerism, some form of giving. I have recommended tithing, so that everybody who can afford it can give 10% of their income to poverty-fighting causes.
Right.
But now it's only about 1% that corporations and the wealthy give to poverty-fighting.
And you have faith that these are private poverty-fighting organizations. You have faith that these groups would there are two levels, do the job and not bloat their own bureaucracies. And secondly, how exactly are they going to go about converting people with no job skills to members of the middle class?
Well, first of all, this will require a tremendous amount of national effort, and it will require people contributing some time to teach others, to be mentors, to kids at risk. And if we don't succeed at doing that, I really believe that this is going to be the coming iceberg that we have ignored that sinks the Titanic. So that's why it's so significant.
Well, we'll find out. Disraeli pushed through the Reform Act of 1832 in order to avoid two nations collapsing the country. But 90 years later, when the Titanic set sail, it had two nations on it.
It definitely did, but at least it was not as bad as it could have been
if
that Reform Act had not passed.
I think you're right about that. The book is called Greetings from the Lincoln Bedroom. Ariane Huffington wrote it. Thanks for talking to us about it today on Book Radio.
Thank you very much, Mark.